It's Wednesday, October 28th, 2020, and this is another socially distant edition of KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from various locations around the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm in the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute, and my colleagues, Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley, are in other corners of our school today.
Hi.
Hello, Dan.
Hello, hello. On our program this week...
You know, I didn't want to have this kind of angry.
Of course you did.
No, I didn't.
Of course you did.
No, I didn't.
Well, that was 60 Minutes. It was the presidential candidate interview that was like no other. President Trump walked out on Leslie Stahl. There's a lot that I want to ask Kathy and Ernest about this. But at the top of my list... was this all part of Trump's strategy? The Lincoln Project, it's one of the biggest names in activist media messaging right now. But what's next after America casts its vote next week? And one of the two biggest newspapers in Utah, the Salt Lake Tribune, ends its longtime partnership with the Deseret News. What are the implications there for the people of Utah? We're going to talk about that and more before our half hour is up today. But we're going to start with that must-see TV from Sunday night. Some of it we saw on Thursday when President Trump released his uncut footage of the 37-minute interview, the breakdown moment that led to the president getting up and walking away.
You brought up a lot of subjects that
I'm going to ask you tough questions.
They were inappropriately brought up right from the beginning. No, your first question was, this is going to be tough questions.
Why?
You don't ask Joe Biden. I saw your interview with Joe, the interview with Joe Biden.
I never did a Joe Biden interview.
It was a joke. The interview, 60 Minutes. I see Joe Biden giving softball after softball. I've seen all of his interviews. He's never been asked a question that's hard.
Okay, but forget him for a minute.
No, but you start with me.
You're president. And
excuse me, Leslie, you started with me. Your first statement was, are you ready for tough questions?
Are you?
That's no way to talk. It's no way to talk.
Kathy, I tried to imagine you sitting in that seat, and I wondered just what would Kathy do if the Donald looked at her during an interview and said, that's no way to talk. That's no way to talk.
Well, you know, there are a lot of comebacks you'd like to think you'd say, but I've got to say that, this is a very hard thing to do it's very easy to criticize an interviewer, but when those bright lights are on you, it makes you not as verbally adept, maybe. But the other thing I would say is that he's the president of the United States. And when you walk into the White House, there's a lot of security and a lot of trappings of power. And one of the things I always tell students is don't be intimidated by that, because there's a natural tendency to be intimidated. And I think what you saw there was Donald Trump using the trappings of power to try to shut down questions. And in the end, I don't think it played well for him, because when a politician walks out and refuses to answer questions, I think that does not reflect well on him. So I don't think it reflected well on him. I think it actually showed he looked like a bully. And that's not a good thing, especially for somebody who is in trouble with suburban women voters.
So, Kathy, tell me, do you think that the questions, were they hard? Were they unfair? Were they that much different? I mean, they were different in context, but were they that much harder, or were they that much more probing than the questions that were posed to Biden later in that same program?
You know, I think, I just don't think you, first of all, I don't think they were. I think they were appropriate questions. Donald Trump is somebody who's been in office for 4 years. Donald Trump is a professional controversialist. He loves to mix it up. And to the question you posed earlier, could this have been part of a strategy? I think absolutely. Donald Trump has, from the beginning of his campaign, made the press kind of a whipping boy. It's a way to gin up support with his base. And I think, you know, that's all fair game for politicians, except, as I've said before on this program, there are people who do take the president a lot more literally than sometimes he takes himself. And in the current fraud environment, that has turned out to be very dangerous, certainly dangerous for reporters. And as somebody who teaches young reporters, I'm very conscious of that. But No, these are questions that any politician, and especially a sitting president of the United States, should expect. You've got to have a thick skin in this business.
Yeah, Ernest, there are a lot of people who are out there saying this was part of a strategy, that he knew walking into the room he was going to answer one or two, that he was going to do that in the same way that he's answered so many before, then take on that bullying tack, and then walk out just in the way that he did. What do you think for a second about that idea of releasing the video ahead of time, that idea of putting it out there right before the debate Thursday night, taking that offensive tack to the defense?
Well, I think it was a planned strategy from the beginning, the whole goal is to try to control the narrative. And one of the things that the Trump campaign has been unable to do throughout this presidential cycle, as opposed to when he ran for office in 2016, is control the cycle. And a lot of it is COVID, a lot of it is the economy, a lot of it is social justice, and the fact that as a sitting president, you're running on your record, and it is difficult to the narrative is your record, and he's trying to basically diminish some of the negativity, which is huge around his record, and promote the positive. And they keep coming back to this one point that I hear over and over and over again, is that before the pandemic, things were great, the economy was great, things were going along, and once we get past the pandemic, things are going to get back to normal. They're going to get back to that to that same sort of great economy. The problem with that narrative is that what are you doing to get us past the pandemic? And that's the part of the narrative that's missing. And so in each iteration, including the 60 Minutes, it was, let's throw the press off their game. Let's try to control the narrative. And we use these kinds of tactics to be able to do it.
So talk for a second about that idea, Ernest, of trying to throw the press off the game. He went after Leslie Stahl. He went after Savannah Guthrie. His approach to Kristen Welker Thursday night during the debate was so very different. He abided by the rules. He praised her at several different points, so much so that the headlines Thursday night and Friday were that his performance showed that he did not come unhinged, which is a bizarre approach to take to covering the president of the United States as the incumbent candidate. But talk about the difference in who he's going after and who he seems to be showing support for.
Well, the difference between the two is that the first debate was so bad that everyone, and I will say everyone, but a lot of people within his camp were saying, okay, you have to tone this down. Didn't have the second debate because the president had contracted COVID and was... and didn't want to abide by the rules that were set forth by the Presidential Debate Commission. You get to the last debate, is his last opportunity to persuade undecided voters. And the way I see it is that he heard the messages from his advisors about what he did in the first one, and they had the rules set up, which would make it difficult for him to do that anyway. So he pretty much followed the rules. And he followed the script. Where I think the problem is, because everyone's been watching the polls and they've been looking at what's going on, is that a lot of people made up their mind before that last debate. And so there are very few undecided voters left. And so in hearing that news, he pivots back to, I got to get my base out.
Yeah.
I got to get my base out. And the one way to get the base out is to use these same sorts of tactics that he's been using throughout his first campaign and throughout his presidency, which is attack the media, attack your opponents in ways that cater to the base, and try to control the narrative and not talk about or be dismissive of all of the negativity that is a part of his presidency.
So we're less than a week away from the last of the ballots being cast. And while most people are laser beam focused on getting folks to the polls and getting out the vote, there are some who can't help but start to think about what comes after. Axios published an exclusive story yesterday about the Lincoln Project. That is the political action committee that's primarily made up of former Republicans working to prevent Trump's reelection. If you're not super familiar with their work, chances are you can relate pretty easily to their messaging, like what you would see in this spot.
I'll put the phone on speaker so she can hear you.
What do you think?
She's in and out. Your girls are on the telephone, Joyce. Joyce?
The reality of that moment is one that most everyone can relate to or at least empathize with. Two sisters saying goodbye to their mother over the phone, with a healthcare worker facilitating the call because COVID prevented the women from being at their mother's bedside. There are others that ask men, real men, to own up to their mistakes and vote for their sons by voting for Biden. The Lincoln Project has worked to get high-ranking officials from the administration of the Reagan and the Bush's presidencies to explain why they are voting for Biden. Ernest, these messages, as the kids say, really hit you in the feels.
Yeah, I mean, the Lincoln Project, I mean, it started out and it was basically they came out and said, this is our attempt to try to save the Republican Party as we know it. Republican Party of President George W. Bush, the Republican Party of George H.W. Bush, and the Party of Reagan. And this is the genesis of the Lincoln Project. And one of the ways that they've gone after this is to speak directly to Republicans about issues that matter to them, that sort of compassionate conservatism that George W. Bush came out with in his campaign. And they've turned that into a media, basically a media operation that sort of caters to trying to bring back that compassionate conservatism. And the question becomes, what happens after the election? What if Biden wins? Then are they in a position to be able to go to Republicans and say, look, if we are going to be a force again in the American political process, this is what we have to do. And they're going to use the various media tactics, the commercials you talked about, social media, trying to get former public officials who were part of that compassionate conservatism of Bush and Reagan to come and speak out. And also, I think part of it is also going to be trying to support them, support candidates who hold on to that compassionate conservatism.
So, Kathy, according to this piece in Axios, really what they're looking to do is create a media company almost in the lines of what the Obamas have created with Crooked Media and their production company. Can you talk a little bit about some of the initiatives that are at least reported in that piece about what could be coming next for the Lincoln Project?
Yeah, what's interesting about this group is this is really some of the top talent in the Republican Party. They are the super creative strategists, the ad makers. The fact that none of them are working for Donald Trump is interesting, let's put it that way. And they have produced some of the most creative and hard-hitting ads of the campaign, way tougher than anything that you see from the Democrats and Joe Biden. So I think.
But what does he need? What does he need to get that creative for if he has the Lincoln Project ultimately doing the work for him?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think and of course let them do the hard-hitting work. It's people from the president's own party. My guess is that this group started out, as Ernest said, and I think it's still part of their agenda probably, is to rebuild an opposition party in a second party. They feel abandoned or unable to connect with their own parties. I think this gets to the problem that we have where there are so many places where there are not competitive races. People do not vote in primary elections. So on each side, on the Democratic side, and but particularly on the Republican side, you have the extremes kind of taking over. And so these are people who are alienated from that on the Republican side. And I think what they are beginning to conclude, as the Obamas concluded, is that right now, in an information age, in an age of saturation media, the way to influence the process is through the media, not through party apparatus, not through the traditional means of political influence, but by making an impact on social media, on TV. And, you know, I think we should say the reason most people in Missouri haven't seen these ads is that our state is not considered competitive. But the other interesting thing about this is the amount of money that this group is spending, and they are really saturating the airwaves in the states that are competitive. So they've raised a lot of money, they have a lot of support, and I think they probably have a group of people who are thinking, you know, we can't get any headwind in the Republican Party. It's controlled by a faction that we don't agree with. We're going to go out and try to end around that by going through the media.
But I do think that it's interesting that this group has the amount of money it has, and Trump is having a problem raising money. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are saying, well, most of it's going to Joe Biden, most of it's going to the Democrats. I think that Biden is getting a lot of small donations. I think that's where a majority of his money is coming from. But to Kathy's point, I think a lot of that money is going, the high dollar money is going to, on the Republican side, is going to the Lincoln Project, because, you know, they don't want to be associated with a lot of the extreme rhetoric that's going on right now, and that is part of the Trump base. And, you know, I don't know if you've been talking about a splinter party, or maybe at some point they'll be able to gain some sort of authority within the Republican Party, but they definitely have the financial backing and the media savvy to be able to affect some sort of change.
Right, and I think this gets to the point we talked about last week about the media landscape, where you have so many publications that are really being, they're really a method of propagandizing. And I think when you have a really splintered media landscape, it's no longer just three big networks or two newspapers in a town, there's an opportunity for people. And I think, you know, they everybody needs to tell their story, right? And they now have the means to do that. It's not expensive to do video production. It's just become so much more accessible that I think more and more for politicians, whether they are Barack Obama on the Democratic side and Michelle Obama, or these Republican strategists, are going to look for ways that they can make a splash in the media, because that's how you reach people now.
Okay, well, we all know, I have some very strong feelings about how those of us in the Midwest and the Mountain West find ourselves covered by journalists based on the coast. I hate the concept, the idea, the term flyover country, and the tendency that national reporters have to treat us like we're some kind of novelty, those quaint folks. Well, I want to have my own Seinfeld moment and pose the same question that Doug Mack asked in a foodie publication for people who are really into restaurant and food and cooking culture. It's called The Counter, and he asks, what is it about all the diners? Ernest, is it just me, or is it that the only place where journalists think they can find real, and I have air quotes going if you're listening to this show, real conservatives to talk to?
That seems to be the trend. I mean, if you go and you look at the story, which is on our links blog,
yeah.
It talks about how this all started mainly with Jimmy Carter back when he was running for president back in the 1970s. And it was all about following the candidate at that point. Where did the candidate go to reach out to voters in certain areas of the country that were considered to be either independent, or they were swing voters, as we call them now? And Jimmy Carter went to these places, and he had coffee with them and breakfast with them. reporters went along following, trying to figure out why is he going to these places. So that's how it started. Now it's transitioned to, this is where reporters are going to find real Americans. These are the people. This is the backbone of the American voter. And it sort of falls into this myth. They're usually white. They're usually conservative. Most of the time, they're men. And they're at these places early in the morning, and they sit around and they talk.
And they're wearing a plaid shirt.
They all wear plaid shirts. And as if there are no diners in urban areas, there are no diners in the city. And it sort of fits into this sort of stereotype that has been created. And the reason it works is because reporters go in, they know what they've already crafted the story in their heads. They're basically going in to ask the questions that they most of the time already know the answer to. And the video is set up. You can jump in, do it, jump out, put it up, and people believe it. When in fact, that's not necessarily what these towns and communities are made up of. And it doesn't really tell the audience how the lived experiences of these people and why they feel this way or that way about their political choices. So I just think it just, again, journalists need to not follow a script when they go in and really talk to people in these communities about how they live their lives and what's.
And those people are our people, right? These are our friends. These are our neighbors. These are the people who, they could be us. Kathy, what advice would you give if you were having this conversation maybe with some of your former colleagues that you worked with in Washington who might be sent out to report on some of the battleground states right now, if they were going into Iowa or if they were going into rural Georgia? What advice would you give them?
Well, I think Ernest said it well, and I think one of the key phrases that Ernest said is the video. And so where you see a lot of the diner interviews is on TV. It's a great visual backdrop. And so obviously, and it also, in defense of the reporters, it's one-stop shopping, as we would say. If you're parachuting into a community and you need to get a lot of people at once, a diner is a good place to go. So there is that. But I think this is the thing. I mean, we are living in a time when news organizations are strapped. We've talked a lot about that. And the question is, how can you get creative on a short budget and short time to try to get to people where they really live, which is not always the diner, and get the people who aren't at the diner. But as Ernest said, you know, I've eaten at plenty of diners in Manhattan, so it's not really the iconic eating place of the Midwest. I would say what I always did is I always tried to find the most competitive state legislative race in the most competitive state congressional race in the most competitive state, and then I would ask a candidate if I could go door to door with him and talk to people behind him, and that's often the best way to get to people, because it's a way that they've opened their doors to somebody, they'll open their door to you too. It's hard. It's really hard to get people talking and to get them honest, but that's one of the challenges of reporting.
So I want to talk about some media news that's coming out of Utah this week. Another thing coming to an end in 2020, daily print production at the Salt Lake Tribune. Here's the paper's interim editor, David Noyce.
Our print product's been getting smaller through the years. You know, the number of pages, daily pages, has declined. It's not surprising given the state of the newspaper industry right now.
Deseret News has not announced how it plans to move forward. Noyce believes the Salt Lake Tribune has its sights set on the future, continuing to offer breaking news online and then shifting the focus of the weekly publication to more in-depth reporting.
I'm hoping that they'll see the proof will be in the product. How it's delivered isn't ultimately as important as the journalism that you actually read and see.
So this paper had been owned by the Huntsman family about a year and a half ago, was changed into a nonprofit status. Ernest, I'm trying to get my head around just how big of a deal this is. They're still going to be producing news content, But it's just going to be online. Really, the big part of this coming in is the end of the operating agreement. Talk about that for a second.
Well, it's the end of the JLA, and this is one of the few joint operating agreements that's still in existence in the country. So the joint operating agreements were basically put together so that these newspapers would share business. The business side, but then the news sector side would be separate. It was a way to keep two news operations open, and especially in major metro areas. So, you know, the problem with this is that I don't know if they're going to be able to sustain that. I think the Deseret News is probably going to take over. The nonprofits are going to go away, and it's going to be one newspaper like you see like across the country. They may be able to keep it up online for a while.
So, Kathy, let me ask you about this. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention this is News Literacy Week. There's a news literacy point to be made here that the Deseret News is owned by the Church of Latter-day Saints. What do we know about how the church has run its media? And if the state, because this does leave the state of Utah with one major daily newspaper that will be available for coins a day, right? There's a digital divide issue that comes in this. So what do we know about how the church runs its media and how independent and how that's going to serve the state?
Well, I think this will be a test for the church. I mean, as they become potentially, as Ernest said, the newspaper of record in the state, you know, as I've said before, there's no such thing as conflict-free journalism. Mm-hmm. The question is not so much who owns the publication, and in some ways having the LDS own the publication gives it some deep pockets, which at a time like this is not a bad thing to have. It's a question of, will they let the news professionals do their job? Are they going to be able to report on the LDS, which is a powerful part of the power structure in Utah? Can they report fairly and freely? And so I think that's the test going forward. And, you know, we'll see how they do. I think scrutiny is a good thing. And hopefully they will measure up. But I think the situation is going to be more typical in many cities. Little Rock, where I used to be a Washington correspondent for the Little Rock paper, and at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, my old boss, Walter Hussman, is doing something very similar. It's an effort to maintain the news gathering capacity while also saving money.
Okay.
It's hard for papers. It's hard to get anybody to deliver papers these days.
So we are running out of time. Kathy, I want to ask you real quickly, I'm putting you on the spot with this. You're going to be participating in an event tomorrow night that is around News Literacy Week. Can you tell our audience very quickly about that and how they can participate?
Are you talking about the Kansas City?
Yes.
Event? Yes. I think they can go on to the Kansas City Star and they can sign up for this event. And it is going to be a roundtable about disinformation and the media and how to discern real news from facts. I have some ideas on how to do that. There are a lot of other smart people who are going to be on the panel, too. So they may have some even better ones.
Okay. Thank you to all of you for spending the last half hour with us today. You can read more about what we talked about and a couple of things we didn't have time for on our links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tab at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Follow us on social media. We're on Facebook and on Twitter at Views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again and ask us questions about next week. Thanks to Travis McMillan for directing the show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll be with you again next Wednesday for another edition of Views of the News.